retro ball player career. Actually, you know, retro or real, he was 15 for 41 and he hit 429. So this is all very good stuff, I'm sure. And as interesting as all this might be, or might not be, I mean, even for a hardcore baseball fan, I think the more interesting insight that we gleaned from this project might very well be an idea of how players may have been viewed differently than they are today if they had the opportunity to include any number of All-Star games in their playing resumes. So for instance, what about the great players who finished their careers before 1933? I mean, would they be considered even greater today? Or how about the players who played in only a few All-Star games and only at the end of their careers? And more interestingly to me anyway, who are those players we don't even give a first thought to, let alone a second thought? Would they be well known today? I mean, these are the questions that were coming to mind as the project unfolded, so we wanted to take a stab at figuring that out. So we think the best proxy for determining how good or how great a ball player's career is the Hall of Fame. Whether and how the player had been inducted and how quickly, or if not, whether he received votes, how many, and for how many ballots. And we believe this also lines up very well with how fans see the players as well. So far, 128 players who played most or all of their career in the All-Star era have gone into the Hall of Fame as players. And of those, 53 of them, or 41%, have All-Star participation listed right on their plaques. Also, Bill James, in his great book, Whatever Happened to the Hall of Fame, cites All-Star participation among his Hall of Fame criteria on his Keltner list. And in Hall of Fame Monitor, he developed in the same book, he awards points to players for each All-Star game they participated in. So All-Star games are clearly a consideration for Hall of Fame induction. Even if baseball writers don't explicitly cite it, it's hard to believe they would completely ignore it. So with that in mind, who in the retroactive All-Star era would have benefited from playing in multiple games had they existed at the time? Let's take a look at some Inner Circle Hall of Famers first. First question we have about these guys in the retro era is, would their legacies have benefited from playing in several All-Star games? Babe Ruth comes immediately to mind. He played and started in two actual games, but had the games begun in 1916, he would have made the team in 16 seasons. That would tie in with Kaline, Mantle, and Rose, and be fewer than only Aaron, Mays, Musial, Ripken, Ted Williams, and Brooks Robinson. Ruth's 15 starts ties in with Carew, and behind only Mays, Aaron, and Ripken. All the players mentioned here are Inner Circle Hall of Famers, well of heroes. However, Babe Ruth is also widely acknowledged as the greatest player in baseball history. So it's fair to ask, how could the Babe's legacy have benefited from starting 15 All-Star games? So here are some other Inner Circle Hall of Famers. We have Walter Johnson. He would have made 6 years and started free. Pete Alexander would have made 9 years. He would have started free. Ty Cobb would have made and started 7 years. Hannes Wagner would have started the last 2 years of his career. Lou Gehrig, he did make 7 games and started in 5, but he would have made 14 and started in 10. The question is, would the legacy of any of these immortals been significantly impacted by playing a boatload of All-Star games from 1969? Now, I think the answer lies in this fact. Every one of these players were Hall of Famers before 1939 came to a close. So judging from that alone, I think we have to conclude that the answer is no. They would not have benefited because these players were already at the pinnacle of their game, or of the game, and by definition, you can't rise higher than a pinnacle. So next we move on to what might be called the middle circle and outer circle Hall of Famers. I have no firm definition for what this is supposed to be, but let's just say that they're players that are elected by the writers, but just not on the first ballot. But these are also players who may have, in a practical sense, benefited from numerous appearances in All-Star games had they been played between 1916 and 1932. Harry Hyman is a good example here. He was a .342, .410, .520 hitter, four-time batting champion, including hitting .403. He had a .148 career OPS plus. That ranks him with the elites of the game. But it took him 12 ballots to be voted to the Hall of Fame. He played no actual All-Star games, but he would have made 9 All-Star starts. Would 9 All-Star starts have helped Hyman reach the Hall of Fame sooner? So here's a list of every player who's ever started at least 9 All-Star games in real life. There are 25 of them. 18 are in the Hall of Fame now. They're in yellow. Of the 7 who are not, 4 are either active or retired, but not yet eligible. Of the 3 remaining who have achieved eligibility, one is very modest. He has his own peculiar set of problems. Another is practically certain to be voted in, and that's Mike Piazza. Only Steve Garvey won't weigh in on votes, although to be fair, no one would confuse Garvey's numbers with Hyman's, or anyone else's numbers for that matter. But just as important a point is how quickly the players got in. 14 of the 18, Nello got in on the first vote, 2 got in on the second vote, and the other 2 got in on the third vote. So that's 18 out of 18 selected within 3 ballots. Now, Piazza's not among them, mainly because he's had the bad luck of going up against a slew of slam-dunk first ballot Hall of Famers coming online at the same time. But I would say he's a lock to get in by 2018. That would be the 6th ballot. It's, you know, 6 is a bit later than 3, but it's still a far sight ahead of 12 that Heilman. But then Heilman had no All-Star appearances to boast. So if Harry Heilman had 9 All-Star starts in his legacy baseball card, perhaps he goes in much sooner. You know, probably, certainly. You know, I think it's probably closer to certainly than perhaps. Bill Terry is another example. He's well known as a guy who was most recent 400 hitter in the NL. He's a 341 lifetime hitter. It's still the 15th highest ever career batting average. It's higher than Gary Wayne and Uso, their inner circle Hall of Famers. 136 career OPS plus. He was a 3-time All-Star starter in reality, but had the game started in 1916 instead of 1933, he would have been an 8-time All-Star and a 6-time starter. It took him 14 ballots to get him elected. So how does Terry's 14 ballots compare with real-life 6-time All-Star starters? Same as Heilman, I think Bill Terry's selection to the Hall seems unusually delayed compared to others who achieved what might have been Terry's level of All-Star renown. Now, Joe Torre is an exception since he crapped out after 15 ballots, but he had a very good 129 OPS plus, but he also had a 297 batting average, which might have hindered him. But Dickey hit 313 lifetime and had an OPS plus of 127. Barry hit 320 with a 124 OPS plus. Puckett hit 318 with a 124 OPS plus. They were clearly not better hitters than Terry, yet they all got in far sooner than Terry. So here are a few other middle and outer circle Hall of Famers to consider. Gabby Hartley was the best catcher in the National League during his career by a long shot. 6 All-Star games and 3 starts would have been 11 games and 7 starts, but he got in on the 12th ballot. Jimmy Fox had a 163 OPS plus. He was a hitter of well over 500 home runs. He did make 9 games and started 4. How did he even go 7 ballots? I mean, maybe 13 All-Star games and 7 starts would have helped him a little. Now, Allison had nearly 3,000 hits in his career, batted over 384 times, 200 plus hits 5 times, 9 ballots to get in. I mean, probably not if he were a 10-time All-Star and an 8-time starter instead of 3-3. And Dazzy Dance, he finally caught on at age 31, but he made up for lost time. He had nearly 200 wins, led the NL in strikeouts 7 straight years, ERA 3 times, he had an MVP to boot, and it still took him 16 ballots. That's just crazy. There's no All-Star appearances, though. That didn't help. But 8 appearances and 4 starts probably would have. Now, the Veterans Committee, even though they take a lot of heat, they do serve as a good backup system for when writers fall down on the job, such as Ron Santo or Art Vaughn. But sometimes they really do address what seems to be an injustice, like Zach Wheat, who fell just short of 3,000 hits to get 317. He would have started 7 All-Star games across 5 years, which might have helped him get an election to the Hall instead of falling off after 16 ballots. Chuck Klein had one of the most amazing 6-year starts in history, including a triple crown and 4 home run titles, even led the league in steals 1 year. He was gone after 12 years in the ballot. Maybe starting 5 All-Star games in his first 7 years instead of 1 would have brought him in. Earl Averill, he had 9 appearances and 4 starts in 13 years. And that's kind of a short career to get voted in on. But he might have at least stayed on the maximum number of ballots instead of falling off after 7. That would have been a little better, right? I think so. You would be forgiven for believing Home Run Baker was voted in by the baseball writers because he had 3 home run crowns, 135 OPS plus, and a really colorful nickname. But in fact, he failed to get elected after 11 tries. Perhaps starting knots in the first 6 All-Star games might have had an impact on him. Now here's my favorite part of the program. I call this one, Do You Know Me? So not every player would have earned a bunch of All-Star games during that year, or would have, or even should have been a Hall of Famer. But even so, many of these same great players are not just not well-known, they're even downright anonymous, even savvy fans of baseball history. Now here's a guy who fills this bill. Does anyone know who this is? Anyone? This is Marty McManus. Marty McManus played 14 years, mostly with the Browns. He got almost 2,000 base hits and 120 home runs, which placed him 3rd all-time among second stackers at the time of his retirement. So he had a pretty good pop. Only Joe Sewell was a better infielder by WAR in the American League, And McManus was the equivalent of Pike Trainer and was better than Rabbit Merrinville. They were both in the Hall. He didn't play in the actual All-Star games, but he would have started three and would have made three more. He would have had six All-Star appearances on his baseball card, which surely would have yielded him more than four total votes in two ballots. All he got. There's another one. You know this guy? Anyone? This is Ken Williams. Now, Ken has an unfortunate name. I mean, it's a nice enough name, but it's kind of plain. You know, it's not Babe or Ty or Hannes or Home Run. But Ken Williams sounds more like Barbie's boyfriend than a feared hitter. But he was a feared hitter. I mean, even more so than his half-brother Cy Williams, who was another home run hitting non-Hall of Famer from the era. Now, Ken hit a bunch of homers with the live ball. He went from 10 to 24 to a league-leading 39 in three seasons' time. He almost hit almost 320 for his career, and he had an OPS plus that rivaled Snyder, Klein, and Reggie Jackson, and he retired fourth in career home runs all time when he left the game. If he were known to have started four All-Star games and made six total teams, I'm guessing he does better than two lone votes total. Now, if you ask this to a knowledgeable baseball fan of today, you might get a blank stare in return. What can you tell me about Larry Doyle? Well, baseball fans of 100 years ago could have probably told you a lot about Larry Doyle, after all. Larry Doyle was the MVP in 1912 and third in MVP voting for the year before that. He was mentioned by baseball magazine as being among the greatest aggregation of batters in the world. They named Cobb, Speaker, Collins, Cravath, and Doyle. He clobbered 74 home runs in an era where that was really something, especially out of second base. And his OPS plus of 126 was only a few points short of Joe Morgan, the same as Robinson Cano is today, and ahead of Behringer, Alomar, Sandberg, and Fritsch. Yet he fell off the ballot after 3 years and just seven votes. I'll bet he had four All-Star starts at the end of his career. People wouldn't know who he was today. Now, I'm closing my two favorites. Larry Gardner. He would have started 2 years and added a third appearance at the back half of his career. He was second only to Baker among third basemen of the era, and he was the best defender of the hot corner at that time. Now, his batting line, you know, especially his 109 OPS plus, it doesn't much look like it belongs to a Hall of Famer. But then, George Kell's OPS plus is 112, only 3 points higher. George Kell is in the Hall of Fame today. Larry Gardner never even received a single vote. But then, George Kell was also a 10-time All-Star, so, as the kids like to say, do the math. All right, this is the last in our parade that should have been All-Stars. This is Jack Freiner. He was a 13-year-old big leaguer, but he was a 13-year big leaguer with a big 3-year Pacific League-sized hole in the middle. He was a 313 career hitter and finished his career with being sixth on the all-time home run list in 1927 with 136. And he led the NL in 1924 with four bombs. Now, he was on four retroactive teams, and he was voted a starter three times. But the best part of his story, I think, is this. The bottom line of his career record looks remarkably like Hap Wilson's. Their OPS plus is almost the same, and Fournier's offensive war is actually 2.5 wins higher. Can you guess what I'm going with this? That's right. Hap Wilson is in the Hall of Fame, and Jack Freiner did not even earn a single vote. Now, I know. Hap Wilson, he set the NL record for homers and Major League record for RBI, and he led his league in homer four times, and he didn't even make an All-Star game himself, although he did make three retro teams. I know all this. But I'm not saying that Jack Freiner deserves a Hall of Fame not because Hap Wilson is in, or even that Hap Wilson doesn't deserve to be in the Hall himself. What I'm saying is this. Without the kind of credentials that help a player's Hall chances, such as like league leadership and key stats or season records, or All-Star appearances, we get a situation in which a player who had essentially the same career as a well-known Hall of Famer ends up being, for all practical purposes, an anonymous footnote in the annals of baseball history. Even casual fans know who Hap Wilson is, but only hardcore baseball nerds have any idea who Jack Freiner is, let alone what he accomplished. And for what he did accomplish, it just seems very unjust that he should not have received even a single vote for the Hall of Fame. All-Star appearances and starts might have helped Freiner's legacy. So, I mean, as sin-gaming baseball geeks, when we first started the retroactive All-Star project, we were most interested in how the games were going to come out, or perhaps showing like who the better league was, or who had the better stars, and how all-star game records might have been good. But as we were getting further into the project, we were starting to realize that the true insights lay in how players who never had the opportunity to play in all-star games during the peaks of their careers had suffered in their legacies and their chances at the Hall of Fame compared to players of similar or even lesser accomplishments in later generations. And the main conclusion we can draw is that other things being equal, all-star game appearances, and especially starts, matter in a material way to players' legacies and their chances for the Hall of Fame, and players who don't have them, I'm sorry, players who have them are far better remembered than players who don't. And that's that.
Jeff, now we have a few minutes for questions.
Well, we started with 1916 because a couple of years ago, when Baseball Reference added splits to their play index, they only went back to 1916. We wanted the structure of the ballots to include first half stats.
So if they were to add the additional splits, you would go back further?
Well, we got a few months into the project when RetroSheet made 1914 available and then Sean made it available on Baseball Reference, but we're so far into the project, we couldn't start over.
Sounds like a part two in the making.
Possibly. Maybe go back to 1901, definitely.
This is great stuff. I can dive in line on line, so it's great, but it's historical.
Great.
So, it seems like what's happened here from a statistical thing is that all the guys you mentioned were lumpy, and I'm a little fuzzy on how long you could have been on the ballot when you started the All-Star voting. They were all lumped into these other guys, and it created this really anomalous situation where they didn't have a level playing field compared to people like George Kell and so forth who came along later. Is that fair? In other words, you came into the process a little bit at a time. Here you have this pig in the python coming in, the very first time that people were considered for the Hall of Fame vote.
Well, I mean, what I was trying to accomplish was, if we had an All-Star game starting in 1960, and we would have had the voting, we would have had people voted in, we would have selected reserves, we would have played the game out, and then over time, players would accumulate All-Star starts, and at that point, we were looking at it and we were saying, there are so many guys here, we don't even know who they are, and yet they were All-Stars of their time, and we have all these All-Stars in later years who are in the Hall of Fame, but they're really, if you look at the record, they're really no better than the players that we don't even know. And that's really what I was trying to highlight.
I voted most and had a lot of fun doing it.
Thank you.
I was wondering if, in the voting, did you notice when the ballots were tabulated who was going to start which year, that a lot of people were voting for stars that they were well aware of, or whether they would actually pick the guy who wasn't known but had actually better stats than that half season. I was looking at better stats.
Right. And I think that there's something to that. I think there are some people who were like, Homer Baker, I know this guy.
Babe Ruth, I know that guy.
But Ken Williams beat Babe Ruth for left field in 1922. So I think people were, I think there were a lot of people who were voting on the stats. I think it was pretty fair along those lines. But I think you're right, too. I think a lot of people. But that's the way real All-Star voting works, too. I mean, Derek Jeter started this year, enough said. So.
I have two questions. One is, how did you pick the sites for the retro All-Star games, the parks that they were going to be played in? And were there any years where you had no people on the roster from certain teams,
what
it used to happen?
Right, so the parts that we chose, we started out in committee in 1916, and when we laid out all the years to select the parts, what I wanted to do was I wanted to create a fair amount of distance between when they would host a retroactive All-Star game and when they would host their next All-Star game in real era. As luck would have it, there were 16 seasons that we did retroactive All-Star games. There were 16 teams that worked out really, really well. They could each get one. So it's, the spread was anywhere from 10 years to 27 years. That was as fair as we could manage. In 1932, by the way, the Phillies got the game, but Shy Park was, they would have deemed it too small, and only had 18,000 at the time. So they would have arranged with the A's to play in Shy. Baker Ball was too small. So they would have arranged with the A's to play in Shy. So, yeah, we give a lot of thought to that as well.
All right, one more question,
real quick.
I have one comment just on the whole thing, and as far as like Gary Holland, for example. One of the things he was up against was the fact that he was up against everybody who had ever played up at that time, and because you could only vote for 10 guys, he had to wait until the guys were playing, you know, Babe Ruth, Christian Maxtons, probably only had five. Cy Young couldn't get in the first ballot,
right,
because he couldn't honor 75% of the vote because the voting was so widespread.
Right.
Because obviously, you know, Bernie was one who was working against him. And I love the project, I hope you go back to 1991. Did you find anybody that said, this guy, you alluded to Rabbi Marinville, absolutely has no business in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I guess, you know, there are probably lots of guys like that. I mean, all the guys at the end, like, you know, like Vernier and Ken Williams and Marty McManus, I'm not making the case that they should be in the Hall of Fame. What I'm saying is, you know, a lot of those guys never even got a vote, or only got a couple of votes. Yet, if they were multiple-time All-Star starters, I think they would have gotten more votes or been on more ballots. And that would have been something, I think. And I think we would know them better today as a result.
Larry Doyle's a pretty good champion.
Yeah.
He does it well.
Yeah.
Cornier is an interesting case because his skills were not appreciated at the time. That's why I wanted to spend a year with him. So if he actually played,
right,
he probably would not have been an All-Star then.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, he was better. He was clearly better than the players he was up against, so he would have gotten in a ball.
He was against a better first baseman in the American League and got sent down.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Chef. Anybody have any more questions?